You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sibling rivalry goes back at least as far as Cain and Abel. For Marie Brenner and her brother Carl, it wasn't that bad, but the fighting continued into adulthood. That is, until Carl needed medical help and his sister ran to his side. In Apples and Oranges, My Brother and Me, Lost and Found, Marie Brenner, best-selling author and writer-at-large for Vanity Fair, chronicles her love-hate relationship with her older brother. It's published by Sarah Crichton Books, an imprint of FSG, and it is my great pleasure to welcome Marie Brenner back to the show. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me.
Were the problems from with your brother there from the start?
Oh, yes.
How much older was he than you?
2.5 years, and we were an absolute cartoon of anger. There we were, red state, blue state, my Texas gun-toting, political right-wing neocon brother. He was the only person in the San Antonio Elementary School who was a member of the John Birch Society. I mean, there I was playing my Joan Baez records, trying to get him not to smash them. We were a textbook case.
Your mother called you Apples and Oranges. But what about that John Birch thing? Well, on your father's side, there were tendencies, perhaps, in that entrepreneurial. But on your mother's side, we're talking about a rather leftist background.
Absolutely. We were like so many people. We were a family of huge opinions, big voices, people needing desperately to be heard, unable quite to listen to each other, masking a lot of who and what they were trying to feel through the shadow of politics.
Were there other Jewish families like yours in San Antonio?
They kept themselves blissfully in the closet if they were there.
Your mother had plans to confront Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara on the war, and your Aunt Anita posed nude for Edward Weston.
Absolutely, and helped bring Trotsky to Mexico. Well, my mother was a Boston beauty, blonde, worked at the OSS, married this big, tall, strapping Jewish Texan, didn't know what hit her, wound up in South Texas in this wild bohemian Brenner family, including my father's sister, Anita Brenner, who was really a rather distinguished writer and editor in Mexico and in New York. In her 20s, she was one of the youngest and only staff members of the New York Times Magazine. This is all through the 1930s, and even interviewed Trotsky for the Times Magazine and helped him come to Mexico.
And many people know her behind because it's in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art, one of the most famous nude photographs of Edward Weston.
Can you imagine her best friend was Frida Kahlo? I mean, Frida Kahlo was the godmother of my cousin. I can't even get my mind wrapped around this, as they say. And one day, my young, fleshy aunt decided to just take it all off for Edward Weston. And this, but he didn't even want to take her picture because she wasn't exactly he wrote in his day book, a great beauty. But he was so inspired by what he later called the pear-shaped nude. You know, who knew that this Jewish girl from San Antonio was going to turn out this masterwork for Weston?
So how did that lead to Carl joining the John Birch Society when he's a teenager? After all, the Birch Society had a strain of anti-Semitism.
Oh, God only knows, Leonard. Thousands of dollars, I'm sure, have been spent with therapists over the decades and on many levels of this family trying to unravel all this. I think one of the things I learned that just applies to so many of us is that just sometimes you can't understand everything in families. Carl just somehow we were in South Texas in the 1960s. It had its right-wing aspects. He glommed on to the blonde debutante girls, the fiesta princesses of our school. Maybe he thought it made him in the cool club. I don't know. It's hard to know. Also, he was a genuine libertarian. My brother, which I now understand now, having spent this wonderful time finally coming together with him and writing about him, my brother was a character out of Ayn Rand. He was a libertarian. He developed from being a trial lawyer into being an absolute expert on apples and having these glorious orchards in Washington State and really being the Howard Roark of fruit.
That's what he called himself.
Absolutely.
So he should have He probably should have called his apple orchards the fountainhead.
Oh, he could do anything. He was an expert on Wagner. He could fly a plane. He could go to. He could shoot every kind of gun there was. He had a string of girlfriends always after him. He was a sexy alpha, impossible, difficult, judgmental apple.
Dated a lot of women, but never married. And he converted, didn't he?
He converted at the end of his life. He did marry, in fact, to a very stylish editor who I had introduced him to when he was in his 30s. It lasted 13 years, and then they didn't go the distance, but they never had children.
So there you are, very different as kids, and he becomes a successful trial lawyer, later an apple farmer, and your father said Jews don't farm, but that's a whole other issue. You followed a more traditional route. You came to New York. Were you fighting all along?
All along, every minute. But then we would have periods like many brothers and sisters where we would be the closest confidants. We were like moose with our antlers locked together. It wasn't that we were distant or that we didn't speak. It was that we vibrated when we got into the room with each other, and we would have our weekly phone calls. Very stilted. How are you? Fine. Are you on deadline? Yes. Then I would try to think of excuses to get off the phone, as he would. There was always this kind of very challenging cotton batting between us. Why couldn't we communicate?
So what happened when he dismissed what he called your ACLU friends in New York or told you that George W. Bush was a great man? Did you just tune out?
Oh, I did all kinds of things. You know, as a younger sister, for a long time, I would just decide that it was worth it to argue. And I would argue and tell him that he was an idiot, and we would have these screaming, shouting matches. That got me nowhere. That got us nowhere. Then I detached myself. That got us nowhere. That got me nowhere. Then, as in later years, I just decided I would have to sort of tune out and brace myself and just try to think it really didn't matter. I never really quite got to that place of serenity, however glorious this sounds, but we did manage to push a lot of the furniture aside.
How much of his personality can be attributed to what you realized was an obsessive compulsive disorder?
I'm not sure.
Was he ever diagnosed?
No, I don't think he was, because he was so successful in his life, and he did have so many friends, and he'd had these, again, this extraordinary life as a fruit man. And imagine, he grew 16 varieties of fruits, 100,000 trees on these beautiful orchards in Washington State. So that is a very detailed kind of practice. He knew everything about horticulture. And if Carl were here, he would say in a very loud, booming Texas voice, "This is all nonsense. You need to know details to be able to raise fruit." He would not agree with the OCD term. I think
he sent questionnaires with the fruit that he sent to you. They sound a little more than just interest in detail.
Oh, it was hilarious. First of all, you would get this box of fruit every year that came with the Carl tax, as we call it in the family. And that was the annoying series of questions that would precede the box of fruit's arrival.
All apples?
Pears. His special variety, that it's a form of an Asian pear called the Arirang, which is all you need to know. But they're very fragile. The skin is thin. So you would get a series of phone calls before the box came. Will you be home on Friday? That's when UPS is coming. You have to be home. You have to put it into the refrigerator. One, you just learned. You didn't say, "This is ridiculous." You just say, "Okay." Then the pears would come. There would be 11 more phone calls. Did it come on time? Did you check the UPS slip? Can I demand a refund from UPS? These pears are expensive to pack. I did it all myself. They would be wrapped in these kind of styrofoam wrappings that look like socks. Then they would have elaborate tape over them. I mean, it was like getting into a time bomb. But there we were. I mean, it was funny. If you weren't ready to scream, you would be laughing.
Was he at all proud of your success? I mean, first of all, it's interesting that he got into apples and you were apples and oranges. But you wrote a best-selling book about the tobacco industry that later became the basis of the film The Insider. You became one of the stars of Vanity Fair. You are one of the key figures in probing the Enron scandal. And we could go through a whole bunch of other things. Most families would be very proud.
He was proud. He absolutely was. He expressed it in odd ways. However, he was proud, and he would always come to New York for whatever event was going on. But, you know, it's easy to say brothers and sisters, jealousy, sibling rivals, jealousy. In this case, it was very – in our case, like many others, it was complicated. The very fact is we both wanted the same thing, to connect with each other. And we both discovered that we were so much more alike than we were different, that underneath all this surface opposites, we were really quite, quite similar in temperament.
So why didn't he come to your weddings?
Oh, because I changed the date. And that wasn't allowed. You don't change the date when you're this kind of an older brother.
My guest is Marie Brenner, whose memoir, Apples and Oranges, My Brother and Me, Lost and Found, is published by Sarah Crichton Books, an imprint of Farrah Straus and Giroux. And congratulations on the reviews. Michiko Kakutani does not generally give a lot of praise to books, but she's a lot kinder to you than she was to Salman Rushdie recently. So how did you learn that Carl was ill?
It came as such a shock. We had been together for Thanksgiving in New York, as we usually were, and suddenly, the day after, a typed letter arrived, FedEx, detailing a kind of a shocking request, and it started off more or less, "I'm asking you to help me save my life." Now, we had been together for 4 or 5 days, the whole week before, cooking together, going to the opera, driving each other crazy as we always did.
Did your daughter like him?
She was mystified by him. He was a confusing kind of distant figure for her, you know, just a kind of a fixture always in our life, but didn't quite understand him. And my brother was reaching out to me. He had a rare, highly unusual form of non-smoker's lung cancer at a very young age, all of 50.
Adenocarcinoma.
And he was in perfect health, a big jock. It came as a shock to him completely, of course, as everything does. As Joan Didion writes, life changes in an instant. And our lives changed together and from that instant on.
Does anyone know how he got this disease?
No, you never really know. But the fact is, when he was young, he joined the Marines as part of his alpha thing, and was trained to run through smoke and fires at Quantico as a young Marine officer. And his theory was that he got smoke damage then. But these are just theories; no one ever really knows.
Now, your way of dealing with it was first you joined him, mm-hmm. but you also at a certain point just researched everything about
yes.
him. This is the journalist side.
Yes.
Well, you probably know more about apples, and you know more about some of his psychological situations than anybody would, except people in the fields.
Well, that's very kind. I'm not sure about that. It became absolutely my life because I didn't want to lose my brother. However complicated and opposite we were, he was my brother. So it became our obsession to try to figure out what to do.
Had he deteriorated so much that he decided that the best thing was to take his own life?
Funnily enough, he hadn't really deteriorated so much. He was using a small portable lung to breathe, and he was coughing. But it was absolutely out of his realm of possibility to think of himself as an invalid. He was extraordinarily brave and very self-possessed. I never saw this coming. I mean, my delusions. Because a part of you, when you're dealing with someone so young, relatively, going through something like this, and it is your brother, is that it's happening to you, and anything, you know, everything becomes out of your own filter, which is, again, one of the great challenges of dealing with a brother or a sister, is that it's so important to try to see them. And there were hints along the way, but he was, again, surrounded with his girlfriends. He was dancing. He was going out dancing. He was going to the opera. He was driving. It's just that in the last couple of weeks, he began to feel physically weaker.
But he told no one. And, then he gathered everything that he owned and everything that could reveal something about him, old letters and his computers and whatever else, and he brought them to the dump.
And drove so happily with a kind of sense of glee and a sense of personal power, which again was very much the Howard Roark idea, that my brother was so fascinating because he had that idea of the power of silence, that you never talk about what you're going to do. He used to say the whale who spouts is the one who gets harpooned.
So erasing every trace of his life?
Every trace in these address books he kept meticulously, but always in pencil.
Well, it's interesting that in Apples and Oranges, you wind up undermining that desire on his part because you've given him, you've brought him back to life here.
It turned out, again, another huge surprise for me writing this was that my brother was the most unlikely guru for me I could have ever predicted. And, you know, again, it's a cliche, but cliches are often true. When you reach out to help someone, often the person who gets the help is you. And my brother had a very strong, again, very independent philosophy. Go forward. You don't stay in the past. You make a decision and you stick with it. And I find myself thinking about these things every single day now.
Had he softened? Had he become less judgmental after you came to join him when he told you that he needed your help?
I would like to say yes, and I think yes, but we all stay more or less who we are. And even 3 or 4 days before he shot himself, we wound up having a huge fight. I was on the way back to New York, and in fact, the book opens with that, where my brother took it into his head that the last thing in the world he wanted was for me to go out and get involved with his apple orchards. You know, it was the last thing he could possibly control. And it's so touching now when I think about it, how we all try to just hold on to our selfhood, and the apples for him and his beautiful orchards were so connected to who he was.
But then he left you a note and he asked you to forgive him for taking his life, and
yes.
Then he added, please turn off the air conditioning. I send you my love now and forever.
Oh, there were files. You know, there were files of instructions and post-it notes. And it was amazing. It was just amazing how detailed and meticulous he was.
So in the end, this book is also a reconciliation.
Absolutely. And how it's really, I think, the central point of it for me is how we really don't see our brothers and sisters. We all are locked in this kind of well of childhood. We're like little minnows swimming in this well. And it's so hard how to get unstuck from the role-playing and realize what connects you rather than what separates you.
Because the past remains so powerful.
The past remains so powerful, and yet what you can bring to each other as allies is absolutely transformational. This changed my life.
What are you working on now?
I'm going out and talking a great deal about this around to different cities about the brother-sister swamp.
Because you find that almost every family has
Leonard,
a sibling rivalry.
Oh, absolutely. And this is like the Asian flu. I had no idea because everyone is so locked in their own sort of me, my situation. But when I go out, you know, dozens and dozens of people will say, my sister, my brother. I mean, you know, I have it even instilled in my own family. I mean, it's just so complicated how this works and how this is a subject that we don't think about enough, and psychiatrists have only started looking at it in the last 10 or 15 years, how brothers and sisters so powerfully affect each other, how the joys, the struggles, what we can bring to each other, why has no one really studied this till the last 10 or 15 years?
Marie Brenner, one of her previous books was Great Dames, What I Learned from Old Women. Now there's Apples and Oranges, My Brother and Me, Lost and Found, also could be subtitled What I Learned from Reconciling with My Brother.
Absolutely.
My Older Brother.
My Older Brother.
It's from the Sarah Crichton Books imprint of Farrah Straus and Giroux. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Marie Brenner will be speaking tomorrow, June 12th at 6:30 p.m. at Madison Square Park at the Farragut Monument. That's at 25th Street between 5th Avenue and Madison. And I gather that also there will be Bliss Broyard, author of One Drop, My Father's Hidden Life, A Story of Race and Family Secrets. Up next, we're going to hear from the gurus of how-to, Al and Larry Ubell, and take a lot of calls. By the way, we have had quite a few of this year's Tony Award nominees on this show, and we have posted those interviews on our show page at WNYC.org. You might want to check that out. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.